from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Housing in San Francisco is famously expensive. According to recent news accounts, even a studio apartment now rents for over $2,000 a month. But cost-conscious renters may soon have a new option, provided they don't have lots of furniture. That's because the Board of Supervisors will soon decide if the city should allow the construction of so-called micro-apartments, tiny 220-square-foot living spaces with smaller rents to match, between $1,200 to $1,500 a month. But critics say it will make San Francisco even less family-friendly and won't solve the affordability crisis. The debate over getting small, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. What's the smallest living space you've ever inhabited? I'm thinking about that question as I look around the radio studio I'm sitting in. It's a nice enough space, about 14 by 14, but I'm not sure I'd want to live here. And yet, it's almost exactly the size of a new breed of apartment now being proposed in San Francisco. Tiny 220-square-foot living spaces, sometimes called micro-apartments, where the kitchen counter can double as a workspace and the entryway can house both a closet and your appliances. Proponents of building small point to projected rents of $1,200 to $1,500 a month, substantially less than the average San Francisco studio apartment. But critics of the proposal say micro-apartments cater too much to the young and the single and do nothing to solve the larger problem of affordable housing in San Francisco. A compromise proposal to build a limited number of micro-apartments in the city is now before the Board of Supervisors. And earlier today, I spoke with Supervisor Scott Wiener about why he believes building micro-apartments in San Francisco is necessary.
We have a housing affordability crisis in San Francisco. It's even worse than it normally is. One-bedroom apartments going for $2,500 or $3,000 in many parts of the city, and even larger studios going for $2,000 a month or more. And we have a lot of people who, if they have to find housing at this point, there's no way they're going to be able to afford that. And a micro unit will give people options for people who either don't want or don't need a lot of space, or people who can't afford a lot of space but want to live alone and don't want to be jam-packed into a roommate situation with four or five other roommates. It's about giving people options that they can afford.
As you know, there are many criticisms that have also been raised about this idea, one of which is that this caters too much to young tech workers and will do little to make San Francisco more family-friendly. What's your reaction to that concern?
I totally disagree. First of all, most tech workers, as far as I know, make enough money that they won't that they can afford more space and larger units. So this housing is not in any way intended for tech workers. In fact, some of the folks who could most benefit from this are seniors, because this is a very good model for senior housing, where you have small units that people live in without large common spaces, student housing, and then group and affordable housing for transition-age youth or others. In addition, we have almost 40% of the city of San Franciscans live alone, and a lot of these people can afford their current apartment but can't afford the equivalent at market rate. And so this will provide them an option if they lose their housing but want to stay in the city. So it's really for those, a lot of these folks, and not for the tech workers. In terms of family housing, I totally agree. We do need more family housing. And these two are not mutually exclusive. We should be building family housing. We should also be building housing for single people, because
and so,
we have both.
And so your concern would not be then that this will sort of chew up valuable housing resources, putting it into the basket of people who only need small spaces and therefore using up available housing resources that could be used for people who need more?
No, we need to be building both, and we can and we have built both. We've always built a mix of housing, larger units, as well as smaller units. I also just want to stress that we already have micro units in San Francisco. It's called roommate situations, where you have a 3 or 4 bedroom apartment. It could be used as family housing, but instead it's taken up with roommates, maybe 1 or 2 per bedroom, sharing a bedroom, sharing a kitchen, sharing a bathroom with no living room because that's been converted to a bedroom. This will give people the option to have their own private bathroom and kitchen and may free up some of those large apartments for actual families.
This will go before the Board of Supervisors this week. A compromise has been worked out that caps the number of possible units under construction. Describe that compromise, if you would, and whether or not you think you have the votes tomorrow night.
Sure. I think we will have the votes, and we did negotiate with folks who were not as supportive of the legislation. The compromise is that the change will go into effect with no cap for student housing, affordable housing, and group housing, such as senior housing. And then for market rate housing, there will be a cap of 375 units so that we can have a number of these projects roll out and see what they look like and then analyze them. And once we hit or come close to that cap, we will do a required analysis and then consider whether to extend the legislation for additional units.
Supervisor Scott Wiener, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And joining us now to take up the discussion on the prospects for building small micro apartments in the city of San Francisco, Sarah Short. She is Executive Director for Housing Rights Committee of San Francisco. Sarah, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And Patrick Kennedy joins us as well. He's the owner of Panoramic Interests, a developer of mixed-use projects in Berkeley. He's also building a development in South America called Smart Space and is a proponent of building these micro units in San Francisco as well. Patrick Kennedy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's begin, Sarah Short, if you would, by explaining a little bit more about the compromise that will go before the Board of Supervisors tomorrow. As Scott Wiener was saying, the cap is for 375 of these units, but that only applies to so-called market-based building. What does that mean exactly, and why are you okay with that compromise?
Well, first of all, that's kind of a misnomer because student housing is indeed market rate. But what it means is that the micro-housing that is simply to serve the general market. There's not a niche or some restriction to a certain population will be capped. The units that won't be capped and that will be, you know, allowed to be developed unlimited are student housing, group housing, and affordable housing. So the cap of 375 will apply to all the other micro units. So as you can see, it's sort of a quasi cap.
And from your point of view, as someone who had concerns about these going forward, respond to some of what Scott Wiener was saying about the fact that, in his view, it's not a zero-sum game, that we can go ahead and build these, but we can still devote resources to the obvious need that everyone realizes for more affordable housing for families in the city.
I think that's true, but I think that, you know, as a city official and as housing advocates such as us, we always have to think about our priorities and we always have to make policy decisions based on the most urgent and pressing needs. And so in this case, I'm not sure why we might be focusing on, you know, this idea that there's a need for the single housing and actually making policy changes. In fact, changes in the housing code based on that when there's documented needs about, you know, family flight and the displacement of low-income families in our city and basically the lack of affordable housing available, especially in larger units.
Sarah Short, Executive Director of Housing Rights Committee of San Francisco. We'd like to hear from you in this first half hour of our topic this morning as we look at this question of building micro apartments in the city of San Francisco. What do you think of the notion? You can join our conversation at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can post your thoughts on our Facebook page or on our website as well. Patrick Kennedy, as a proponent of these kinds of new developments, what's your response to the idea that we're focusing perhaps on something that needs less attention than the broader needs of affordable housing in San Francisco?
I think that one needs to step back and look at the larger picture, and that is just the complete shortage of rental housing writ large in San Francisco. And I think that the shortage of single-family housing and the high rents for single-family housing is in large part driven by single people cannibalizing that stock because they don't have any place else to go. And I agree with Scott that it's not a zero-sum game, and that producing more housing specifically for this large demographic will take pressure off sites that are appropriate for single-family homes and for multifamily dwellings for families. And I must say that I share Sarah's desire to produce more affordable housing. And when I developed in Berkeley, 20% of all the units that I built there went for below market rate housing, which was actually more than was produced by the City of Berkeley Housing Authority. So I think we do share the same goals. It's just a matter of how we get to them.
Sir Short, are you concerned that this could wind up exacerbating the problem, that it would drive up rents because it would promote what some people have referred to as a temporary lifestyle, that people will gravitate to these tourists, people who can afford it, and that it will make the remaining housing stock that much more valuable and wind up driving up rent in a sort of counterintuitive way?
Absolutely. That's a huge concern of ours. We have to remember that because these are newly constructed units, rent control will not apply. The rents will be determined by the market. And by nature, these units are actually more costly to the consumer than the average.
Do you mean on a
square foot basis? That's right.
Let me just give the math, if I might. As I understand it, a studio apartment that is somewhat under 500 square feet works out to be about $4.20 a square foot. These apartments would actually cost more like $6 a square foot. Is that right?
That's right. So the rents are actually higher. Well, they may be cheaper than a larger size apartment, a studio apartment. They are by no means affordable, what I would consider affordable housing. And in fact, we may have the opposite effect, which is created by the rents being high enough that, you know, adjacent developers and landlords in the neighborhood realize, well, they can start getting a little more bucks for their units as well. And therefore, the rents go up. You see a different demographic moving in. You see different businesses that are catering to the new population. You lose the services that are provided and necessary for the existing families that live there. And that's what we've seen create family displacement in the past and why our city has changed so much thus far.
We've got a full set of phone lines, people who want to join in this conversation. Let's hear what people are thinking about it. Bobby joins us first in San Francisco. Bobby, go ahead.
Yeah, hey, my question is, or my statement is rather, is that isn't the whole thing with families in San Francisco somewhat a red herring? I mean, we hear city politicians talk about doing this or that for these mystical families in San Francisco, but let's face it, there's no families in San Francisco anymore. And the housing is among single young, and this is what it takes to allow people that aren't working at Google.
Bobby, you're breaking up a little bit, so I'm going to have to let you go. But I take your point. Sarah, quick response, then I'm going to hear from Patrick on this, too, that the reality is this is as Scott Wiener pointed out, 40% people in the city live by themselves. It's a young person, single-oriented city.
Well, let's talk about why that reality is. Families have been priced out of the city, period. Families, there have been studies and there have been, chronicle stories looking at this phenomenon, and families have over and over stated that the cost of housing is their number one reason for having to leave the city. So the reason we have 40% singles now is because of our lack of, good policy that's addressed the housing problem for families. And so, I mean, that's a really important question, I think, that we need to be asking at this time is, do we create policy to accommodate the changes and to, court the newcomers or, provide for the needs of this new demographic? Or do we look at what would be the best solution to help maintain the current populations and communities that we have who every day are thinking about, is it time for me to move across the bay?
Patrick Kennedy, chime in on this point and a response that your eyes aren't on the right prize.
Yeah, well, I think Sarah's parade of horribles is misguided, because right now you can build 280 square foot units in San Francisco, and there's certainly no evidence that there's a massive construction of those displacing family housing and family housing sites.
That's the current minimum, and the proposal is to take it down to 220, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, de facto. So there's been very few small units built, period, in the city. So the idea that modifying this requirement to provide more housing for singles is going to devour all the existing sites is, I think, an illusion. And I think that the laws of economics suggested that the high rents in San Francisco are largely driven by the shortage of options for people. And we're only asking for the opportunity to create more options.
Yeah.
You know, another important thing about these small units development is a lot of small sites that are largely undevelopable because they're not economically viable could become micro apartment sites, which would relieve pressure on other parts of the city.
Ken in San Francisco has our next question. Ken, go ahead.
Okay, that's the big question, relieving pressure. Using the freeway analogy, we know that if we build it, they will come, meaning that it's futile to add more road capacity, i.e. an extra lane, because building it actually increases, not decreases, traffic congestion. Does the same thing apply with housing? And my big reservation as a longtime resident of San Francisco is just giving little units for the folks who make good salaries and jump on the Google bus and go to Silicon Valley, meaning they're not really community members.
Yeah, yeah. Ken,
investment in the community.
Take your point, Sarah.
Agreed. I think we need to think about the importance. Again, what we're doing is talking about making a significant change in the law. And why are we doing this? Especially as Patrick Kennedy stated, nobody's really been building these at the current 290 square foot. So I'm just not sure what the urgency is. And I'm not necessarily saying that other opportunities will be missed because of this, as Mr. Kennedy said. What I am saying is that the argument that there are 40% singles, and so therefore we have some type of mandate or city responsibility to create housing that serves those needs, is not a very meaningful argument. And I think that the truth is, we just don't know what this will mean for our city. It's an untested housing type where we'd be going down to the smallest size of anywhere in the country. And we need to just be responsible in how we do it with a measured approach. And that's why we want to see, a specific amount and a study that reviews it. And then we can reauthorize it. If it's all that people like Mr. Kennedy and Supervisor Weiner say, well, great. Maybe it does benefit a certain niche and it relieves pressure. And then we'll know. And then we can, keep going.
And what do we know, Patrick Kennedy, about the experience of other cities? Because this San Francisco is, as much as San Francisco likes to think, it leads the way. In this particular arena, this has been tried in other places, right?
Oh, yeah.
Seattle,
Vancouver.
Boston, Chicago, Vancouver.
Yeah, exactly. And it's been wholly beneficial. It's brought entry-level workers to the downtown cores of the various cities where it's been tried and enhanced the lives of everyone around them. Vancouver, for example, just opened a renovated SRO with 230 square foot units to universal acclaim. And Seattle's had these micro units for now for, I think, 7 or 8 years. The abuse by part-time residents has not materialized, and the affordability level for entry-level workers has been improved. So I'm mindful of Ms. Short's desire for caution on this, and I applaud the board for proceeding even with a quota. But I think the quota is misguided, because I think it will limit. I don't think it's a big enough sample size to actually determine just what the impact is. And, 375 units is could conceivably just be one project, but at least it's a start.
Here's some comments coming in on our Facebook page. Michael writes, I'd love to be able to rent a 220-square-foot apartment in San Francisco. I've been searching for months for anything, even a room, within my college budget, but it's been difficult. Chauncey writes, as a single 52-year-old woman living in San Francisco, I'd be thrilled to be able to rent a tiny, legal, fully equipped apartment with my own kitchen and bath. And Joyce writes, what about reviving a 21st century version of the boarding house, central kitchen and dining space for X number of suites that comprise a bed and sitting area, and then a whole bunch of tiny complete apartments? A whole bunch of tiny complete apartments makes no sense to me. What about that idea, Patrick? Has that been tried anywhere where you'd have rooms but then a common kitchen that people could share?
Well, actually, it has been tried quite successfully in Copenhagen and some other Scandinavian cities. And I think a version of it might be appropriate here in San Francisco. The one problem is banks are pretty reluctant to lend on something like that because it sounds more like a hotel than an apartment building. And banks like to lend on buildings that they are familiar with. And a studio apartment is a pretty familiar idea for most banks, but something like that or a hybrid of something like that would be perfectly appropriate for San Francisco, I think. I think San Francisco is a wonderful place to live, and I think a lot of people will sacrifice space just for the opportunity to be in the thick of it, and that's what I'm trying to propose.
And Andrew in San Francisco has our next comment. Andrew, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. It's interesting your guest just mentioned being in the thick of it, because it seems to me that there are the thick of it would comprise the desirable parts of the city. There are other parts of the city. You just drive down Market Street, you see boarded up buildings, the Tenderloin. There are tall old buildings. I don't know who's living there, but my guess is that these are places that offer more low hanging fruit in terms of being able to be developed than what might be a developer's dream, where they can get $6 a square foot for rent. Versus $4 a square. I mean, $4 a square foot for a studio. That's a 50% increase. So I have nothing against developers. I think it would be fine to have this the micro units. But in general, you have the avenues, you have whole swaths of the city that, it, in terms of changing the zoning for the existing stock. Could open things up. The building department puts all kinds of restrictions on what you can do with your place, and it seems like we could start with what we have.
Andrew, I'm going to hold you there because we're almost out of time for this part of our program. But are there restrictions on where these can be built, Sarah Short, or is it open territory?
There are zoning restrictions having to do with density, and so that's why we can see exactly where we will find these built, which is primarily in the South of Market neighborhood. And it's communities and residents there that have been really strongest in opposing this concept, because they see it as a threat to their particular neighborhoods.
And Patrick Kennedy, we have to leave this segment in just a minute. We'll continue after the break and talk more about how you live small if we're going to pursue this. But if the board votes, as it's expected to approve this proposal, you're ready to go forward and build?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think micro units are going to be a significant part of the future of San Francisco and many other American cities.
Patrick Kennedy joining us for this first part of our discussion of micro apartments. He's going to develop them, he hopes, in San Francisco. Sarah Short joins us as well. She's executive director of the Housing Rights Committee of San Francisco. When we return, we'll talk more about the how of this. If you're going to live in a micro apartment, how do you manage a small space? How do you get the best out of that space? What's necessary to make it feel right in terms of the kind of furniture you have or the kind of light you use? We'll talk about all of that when we return, and we'll take more of your calls as well at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. In this week for Michael Krasny, our topic this hour, building so-called tiny micro apartments in the city of San Francisco. The Board of Supervisors will vote on a proposal to allow construction of 375 units of those type of apartment in the city. The size, 220 square feet, that's lower than the current minimum size for new construction, which is 290 square feet. And in this final part of our program, we're going to take up what it means to live small. If you're going to live in a small space like that, what does it take? What kind of design works best? How high do the ceilings have to be? What kind of furniture do you need? How do you go about living in a place where your closet also doubles as the place where your appliances are and all the rest? We asked this question on our Facebook page. Here are some of the things people wrote in about living in small spaces. Now, Angela says, my dog and I normally live in a 19-foot trailer, which is about 150 square feet. My biggest issue is the small shower. But I like a small space. It keeps me from accumulating random stuff. And Jim writes in, other than being a shipboard in the Navy, my smallest space is my 150 square foot studio apartment in Sunnyvale, perfectly comfortable for one person. We take up the topic now of what it's like to live in a small space and how you can go about doing that with Miranda Jones. She's style editor for Sunset Magazine. Miranda, good morning.
Good morning.
And joining us from New York, Maxwell Gillingham Ryan. He is the founder of ApartmentTherapy.com and author of Apartment Therapy's Big Book of Small, Cool Spaces. Maxwell, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And we welcome your calls as well at 866-733-6786. Your thoughts on what it's like to live small and whether or not you think it works. And just to get our conversation going, let's take a call right away. It's from Greil in San Francisco. Greil, go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
How you doing, man? I love the show every day. Let's work. Well, the micro apartments is a horrible idea. Horrible idea. You can tell by the price range of the rent. Should be $800 to $900 at the most if they really want to take care of the people. If they really want to do some good for the community, it'd be like that. You see the high rent. My mother lives across the street from the apartment where they're about to build one of those. You're only going to see them cubic apartments around the housing areas, low-income areas, you know, more people, more parking, more congested. You know, there's nothing good coming out of that except making money for the people who build it.
So, Greil, would there be anything that would make you want to live in a small space for you that just wouldn't work?
Yeah, if I was homeless and if I had nowhere to go, I would love those. I would love one of those, you know, to get out of the street, live in a nice little cube, little tent type thing, little, you know, that would be lovely. You know, but for the school kids and what they're saying, you know, it's all propaganda. It's not worth it in you know, the people who are going to live there. You know, after a while, they're not going to like it. You know,
okay.
They're not, it's too congested.
All right, Greil, thanks. Thanks for getting us started on our conversation. So you heard the concerns that someone like Greil has, Miranda Jones, about it being just too congested. Is there a way to make a small space feel something like other than living in a closet?
Even if you do live in a closet, there are ways to maximize the space. The top three things to keep in mind for living in a small or unusual space, which is what most people who live in San Francisco or New York are up against, are keeping your items very well edited, which means, you know, keeping surfaces clean, you know, when you bring something into your apartment, taking something out of your apartment, and quality versus quantity. The second thing is, you know, all unused space is fair game. You've got to take your storage vertical. You've got to prop up your bed so you've got extra storage under there. You just have to look at space differently when it is at such a premium. Also, because there's no room for anything extra, everything has to do two jobs. That means all your furniture has to have two jobs. And that means that your dining room table is also your office space. Every door is a possible storage location. So those are the top three things that I would say are important for keeping any space livable.
We've posted, by the way, on our website a video tour of a tiny apartment. Patrick Kennedy, who was with us for the first half hour, gives a video tour of his sort of demo apartment, which is even smaller than the 220-square-foot space. It's about 160-square-foot space, which is actually smaller than the radio studio that I'm sitting in right now. And everything does indeed do double duty. Is that sort of the secret, Maxwell Gillingham Ryan, that you have to – this is where design, right, really becomes crucial because everything has to be neat and clean and do double duty. You can't have anything extraneous.
Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't always have to do double duty, though. I think of – Americans have gotten used to living in larger spaces. It's part of our cultural heritage. And so, in a way, large spaces just allow you to be lazy. and to not have to deal with stuff until you till much later when your space fills up. And with most everybody, after about 7 years, they have a clutter problem. With a smaller space, it just comes a lot quicker. So in a way, it's just a way of thinking about living smarter rather than living with a constraint. It really is about keeping stuff focused, keeping things organized, and then making your home work for you. It maybe things are going to do double duty, but it may mean you also just take stuff out of your home.
Hmm.
For example, I lived for many, many years. I lived in a 250-square-foot apartment, then got married. My wife and I lived there. Then we had a baby, and we all three lived there for a year and a half until we moved. And what it meant was I started to do all my bills and office stuff at my office. And I had used to do that stuff at home, and I moved that all out. And you can, there's a lot you can do in other places. Your home doesn't have to be everything all the time.
So in a way, it really, you're suggesting that it allows you to focus your home space on being home as a part of, yeah, as opposed to being a multi-purpose place for everything in your work life.
Yeah, and a lot of people, Americans in general, try to want their home to be everything for them, even if they don't use it all. So it's really about deciding what you really want to use, how you want to use your home, and doing it. And most of the time, there's enough room for that.
866-733-6786 if you'd like to join our conversation about what it means to live small, whether that's a good idea for the city of San Francisco, and how you go about making that work. Let's hear next from Kelly, who joins us in Berkeley. Kelly, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Great. Yeah, I just wanted to comment that I live in an apartment. I have lived here for about 2 years. It's well under 200 square feet. In fact, I think it's about 175 square feet, if I'm being generous. And I really enjoy the comments about making home your home space. It's really where you want to live. One of the best advantages I have is, as a single woman working in the nonprofit sector, living alone is affordable in a space this size, and it's absolutely livable and absolutely cozy.
So what do you, if you don't mind saying, what do you pay for rent, Kelly?
I pay $650 a month.
So it then also leaves you money for entertaining in other ways, right? So that you don't, you use, I suppose, the city of Berkeley to go out more as opposed to trying to entertain in?
Exactly. And sometimes I do entertain in. I've been having some pizza nights here at my apartment where I provide the dough and the cheese and my friends bring the toppings. And I'm able to squeeze maybe 4 or 5 people in. It's cozy, but, you know, we have a good time and we make the most of what little furniture I have. And I mostly just like being in the city center. Everything is really within an arm's reach. I live a block and a half from downtown Berkeley BART, and I am completely independent without having it cost a whole lot of money to be sort of in the thick of it all.
Kelly, thanks. Thanks for including your point of view in our program. Part of what that makes me think about, Maxwell Gilliam Ryan, is a comment I read once that when you live in these small spaces, you have to use the city as your living room, that you really need to sort of expand your concept of how and where you live.
Absolutely. And that's why I stayed in my apartment for so long. I love the neighborhood. And we're talking about micro units in very dense urban centers. And you know, there'd be no point in building these in the countryside. The reason I think that they make sense is that you have a smaller footprint in terms of your home. It really becomes, it can be a cozy retreat space where you can rest, sleep, have your privacy, and then you're going to live out in your neighborhood a lot more. And in most cities, neighborhoods are richer and offer a lot of things that people want to be close to.
And if you're only spending $600 a month on rent, as Kelly is, it gives you that many more options. 866-733-6786 if you want to join our conversation about how to live small. Email us at forum@kqed.org or add your comments on our Facebook page or on our website. Randy Jones at Sunset Magazine, one of the things that struck me when I looked at Patrick Kennedy's video demo, which is really fun to do and is posted on our website about his micro apartment, is that it had a great view. You looked out at the Bay Bridge and you saw the bay stretching out before you. And that in itself, I would think, might be important in making these spaces work, that somehow you have a sense of space, whether that's a high ceiling or a view.
Absolutely. I think that that's really important. I don't think that all small spaces are created equally. And if you've got natural light, high ceilings, and natural materials in the apartment, you're going to feel as though you're living well, even though you're living small. I think that's very, very important. Also, access to outdoor, just as Maxwell was saying, is really important. Not only the neighborhood, but a green space that's nearby makes you feel like you're living a richer life, even if your space is incredibly small. But there's lots of ways that you can also make an apartment work for you if it doesn't already have all of those things. You know, painting is a very affordable, you know, people talk about it all the time, but it can't be said enough.
So what are some of the keys, Maxwell, Gilliam, Ryan, about are there specific dimensions actually that matter? In other words, if you're considering this, do ceiling heights have to be a certain height? Does it matter if it's long and narrow versus more square? Do those sorts of very fine details matter?
They do. And as Miranda was saying, they can play a big role. But unless you have the luxury of designing it, which is what they're doing with these micro units, you often, as a renter, don't have a lot of control over that. So the stuff that I've learned over the years and that I teach people has to do with taking the space, whatever you've got, and making it feel bigger.
And how do you do that?
I have three things I do. One is I always tell people, don't buy furniture. Spend your money on built-ins whenever possible, because built-ins are wall-to-wall. They suck up all the empty space, and you can use every inch. And visually, it's a lot less. It'll create a lot less of a busy space.
It's just on that point again. I keep referencing this video, which is on our website. But that's one of the points they make, that if you have built-in lights, for example, it's one less thing occupying space.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's a nice thing about these micro units. We just went to a review session on Friday here in New York with Mayor Bloomberg. They're doing the same thing here, and what they're trying to do is design it so that you don't need a lot of that stuff, and it's in the walls, and that makes sense. The other thing, second thing, is just light. You want more light in the space. Light is what makes a space feel expansive instead of contracted. Shadows contract, light expands. And if you don't have natural light, and as Miranda said, that's the best light to have, you can do it by having more light fixtures in your home. I always tell people 3 points of light to every room. It doesn't seem like a lot, but every client I've ever worked with usually has trouble getting to two. Light colors, light, it doesn't have to be white. It can be off-white colors. There's still color in off-white.
It's not a very broad range, white or off-white.
it's a lot. There's a lot you can do between cools and warm colors that can really change the feeling of the space. And it also makes, if you do a bright white on the ceiling and you do an off-white on the walls, there's a separation between wall and ceiling, and it'll make your walls feel taller. And the last thing is mirrors. And I've seen people over the years use mirrors in such incredibly inventive ways that they not only reflect light, expand the space that they're in, but they can make the space brighter, and they can just remove that sense of wall that is there otherwise.
Let's go back to our calls. Yvette in San Francisco doubts whether or not this can work. Yvette, go ahead.
Well, I've lived in small spaces, and I now have much bigger space, and I just find it very claustrophobic. It's almost like a cute little design prison, but, you know, I have art supplies, I have shoes and clothes, I have tons of books. I mean, where would I put all these things? You know, about the paper storage again?
Yeah, great question. What do you do with books? Maxwell?
From a big space to a small space?
Yeah, well, just the idea of books. I mean, Yvette brings up a good point. If you're a big reader, what do you do?
Well, I say to people, if you have a collection that you love and you really love it, and you can't have 10 collections, but you maybe got one, then make your space about that collection and move other things aside to make more room for your books if that's what you care about. If books are just important to you, but it's just because you're attached to books and a lot of people are attached to their books, then I would recommend looking hard at them and curating down your collection so that you can work within the space that you have and leave space open. Go further than the space you have. Always leave 10% of the space on your bookshelves empty.
Huh.
And what that's there for is if you love books and you really want to get more, you'll be mentally compressed if you are full to the brim. You want to open up space so you can always acquire new books, new ideas, and let go of the old ones.
It's interesting as we're considering this that it also seems true, Miranda, that this is an idea that's going to only fit certain kinds of individuals. I mean, you have to have the right kind of mindset for this, right? And the right approach to possessions. Not the right, I don't mean right or wrong, but it's not going to work if you, as Yvette, is a painter, let's say, or has, necessary additions to her life. It's only going to work if you're a certain kind of person, yeah?
I think that it can work for everybody, but you also have to have the things outside of your house that fulfill the other needs. And not everybody has that luxury. I mean, it's hard to say exactly where these micro units are going to be. Are they within walking distance of a place that you could also have a studio? So I think they could work for everybody under the right circumstances. But for a certain kind of personality, this is a really wonderful design challenge and living challenge. And somebody who likes to have a well-curated and edited life, that, this is a perfect opportunity for them.
Vicky writes, you should tell designers and photographers to stop shooting micro apartments with wide-angle lenses. Every photo feature on micro apartments distorts reality. Where do you stand, Sunset Magazine?
I can personally say that we do not shoot with wide-angle lenses. We try to capture a space best we can without a wide-angle lens. We have featured a lot of small living solutions in the magazine, and we find them very interesting because although the West is known for its expansive space, a lot of people don't have that luxury, and so we're always exploring those options, and we try to photograph them as realistically as possible.
Let's hear from Leslie next. Leslie, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I am an interior designer in San Francisco. My company's Lab Experiment, and I work a lot with small spaces. I feel like I'm working at my best when I have limitations and can work out the puzzle of fitting everything in. I wanted to echo some of the things that Maxwell said about built-ins, and I don't think that has to be expensive. I think you could make a really nice built-in with an IKEA kitchen system. And I also wanted to say that not everything has to get smaller when you're moving into a smaller space. Sometimes it's better to go larger with some things like artwork to make your space feel larger and not have a lot of small pictures, but have one really large one to make your space feel larger.
Leslie, thanks. Thanks for the observation. Do you concur with that, Maxwell, that going big with certain kinds of art, for example, can actually make a space feel more expansive?
Yeah, because, and as she said, it's absolutely right. A space is big or small based on how it feels, not on its square footage. You can be in a big space that's poorly designed, and it will feel small, tight, contracted. You can be in a small space that's really well done, and it can feel very open and expansive. And so those things I mentioned are definitely, they're almost like stagecraft tricks to make the space feel bigger. The space And where the feeling comes from is the eye. You don't walk around your room touching the walls and then come back to the front door and go, wow, this space is small because I've walked it. You walk in, turn on the lights, and your eye travels immediately through a space and comes back, and a feeling comes back to you. Ah, I feel good here. I feel this is a big enough space for me. And so one of the tricks is actually, instead of making everything miniature, while you do have to optimize the space, every now and then you go the opposite direction and you make something bigger, taller, and that creates the variety. It creates breathing. A full breath is an in-breath and an out-breath. And so going small in some spaces, say your in-breath, but getting bigger is your out-breath.
Leslie, thanks. Thanks for the call and the suggestions. Let's go next to Jim in Oakland. Jim, go ahead.
Hey, hi. I just wanted to comment. Thanks for the great program, and I wanted to comment about living in small places in Europe. Particularly, I lived in a small space in Paris of about 120 or 140 square feet, commonly referred to as a chambre de service, is a room that was set up in the early, late 19th century for servants. And it was quite pleasant. And in fact, of all the places we lived, it was probably the most charming and pleasant because it was uncluttered, and the space was more than enough to make one happy to be in a city like Paris.
Jim, thanks. Thanks for the observation. And let's hear a counterpoint to that point of view next from Susan in San Jose. Susan, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'm really against this idea. It reminds me of these cage homes that I saw on TV in someplace like Hong Kong, where people were literally living in cages on top of each other, and I just think it's really degrading. And I also think it encourages isolation to have such tiny spaces that it really can only be lived in by one person, and they can't really have friends over. There's just nowhere to go. So this is not going to help families. And the square footage, the high price, that's the tip-off that this is exploitation.
Susan, thanks. Thanks for the observation. What about that sense that it encourages isolation? Miranda or Maxwell, any thoughts about that, that it's closeting people and doesn't sort of encourage a sense of broader community?
I could say quickly, having lived in a really small space for a long time with a family and given dinner parties, like Miranda said, if you look at popular restaurants in New York City, they tend to be packed, and they tend to be shoulder to shoulder with people at other tables, and people love that. I don't think small means isolated at all. I think small can be cozy as well. Could micro apartments be manipulated in a bad way? Sure, they probably could, but I don't think that's where the impulse is coming from. I think, from what I've learned, the cities are looking around at their housing stock, and especially in the city center, they're seeing that a lot of people already are choosing to live as single people or two-person families, and they're trying to figure out if they can create a variety of space to accommodate those and lower their costs. Because I think if you were to say to me, we're going to do these micro-apartments, but the rents are going to be high, I'd say, well, then there's something wrong with this.
Right.
We're trying to drive rents down, give people appropriate spaces. May not be their home forever. It's a rental. But it should be the right shoe for the right person, and it should be freeing. Like one of our callers said, it allows her to live closer to the center and have more money in her bank account for other things she wants to do.
Naomi writes in, no one mentions the emotional impact of small living. It's not a charming life with less possessions. It's a life of deprivation. To survive in the city, you must give up family heirlooms, art collections, space to breathe. Animals require space, and so do we. It also deprives a person of meaningful social activities in the home by driving them to bars and restaurants. So again, this concern that it deprives you of meaningful things in your life and that it has a detrimental emotional effect. Miranda?
I think it really depends on what kind of person you are and what you crave as a person. I think that for some people, it would be emotionally crippling and feel very isolating. But for others, I feel as though they would view it as a safe haven, a way to get away, a place that's just theirs, a cozy little nest. I really think it depends on the person.
Kathleen in Santa Rosa, you're up next. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment that I think that having a lot of small places like that would be much more livable if the same building structure included rooms that could be used for parties, for social gatherings, large kitchen for big meals like Thanksgiving, rooms that could be rented to family. In other words, you could do it a little bit more like co-housing, and it could be much, much friendlier and more community-oriented.
Yeah, really interesting point, Kathleen. Maxwell, any experiments that going on?
On Friday, we were at the showing of the micro units, and it's supposed to be top secret. We're not supposed to talk about it, the designs. But
go ahead.
That's what they're doing. They're exactly that. They're actually moving, in the plans we saw, they're moving laundry up to each floor. They have a common room. So actually, they're trying to create common space as an overflow for the smaller private space that could do exactly that, but actually decrease isolation and increase socialization.
And what about sort of larger communal living spaces? It's like when you stay in a hotel. Sometimes you'd like to go down to the lobby and just hang out, especially if it's a nice space. I mean, is that being considered?
I can't speak to the beyond the floors that we saw, but I'm sure that the thinking is, if the private space is going to get smaller, so you're stealing space from the private, you can make up for it by pushing it back into public space, but you don't need as much to do that.
Yeah. Victor in Cupertino, go ahead, please.
Hi, I was wondering if the guests could speak on if they have any tips on entertaining guests, like out-of-town guests, or just throwing a party in such a small space.
Yeah, great question, Victor. Thanks. We heard earlier from Kelly, who said she had a pizza party where people not only came, but they brought the pizza and the toppings. So it's interesting to imagine how that used up the available space. But what about that? Tips for entertaining, Miranda?
I think that you have to look at entertaining in a different way. It's not going to be quite as formal if you're entertaining in a small space. But like Maxwell was saying, you know, part of the fun of being at an exciting place is being shoulder to shoulder with your companions. And you just have to remember that people don't mind being crowded. They all want to be in the kitchen anyway.
Yeah.
And in a small space, they probably will be. So, you know, have friends bring over the things that you can't store yourself. And then, you know, every space is a space for something. People can sit on the floor. People can sit on the bed. Just think of it as a romper room more than anything.
Maxwell?
Yeah, I gave a lot of dinner parties in my old space, and the only thing that changed for me is I had to get everything done before people came. And because I didn't, you know, you didn't have all that moving around space for actually still cooking the dinner, so I was just much more organized about it. But I want to just, when I hear the fear thing come up around things getting smaller, Miranda's right. It may not be for everybody, but I do think it's very American to be used to big spaces, but one of our most famous designers, Charles Eames, said he's never accepted a compromise willingly, but he will always accept working with a constraint. And I think if we see small spaces in this light as a constraint, it's actually an opportunity to unlock our creativity and new things can happen.
One last email. Ting writes, my husband and I were very comfortable in our one bedroom and had planned for extra space for our child's crib and storage, but we didn't account for kid-proofing that requires we not keep much below waist level, and now she's climbing up on everything. So where do we keep everything? So how did you manage with your young child, Maxwell, when you were in that small space?
Well, she's a very good girl. She was crawling. When she started to walk, that's when we moved. So that was about a year.
So it not only requires a certain kind of personality, it requires a certain kind of behavior. we'll leave it there. Maxwell Gillingham Ryan, founder of ApartmentTherapy.com, thanks so much for being part of our program.
Thank you very much.
And Miranda Jones, style editor for Sunset Magazine. Miranda, thanks as well.
Thank you.
We'll have more on this on our website, including a video tour of a tiny apartment. If you'd like to take a look at what they're like, you can go to our website, which is kqed.org/forum. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Amanda Supai is our engagement producer. Paul Ancour is our engineer this morning. Dan Zoll, our senior editor. And Raul Ramirez, our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson, in for Michael Krasny. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.